Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, April 20th, 2013. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and I'm glad to say we have guests live here in the studio who've arrived from Germany in the last 24 hours, who are going to give us a report back on an international forum held there April 13th and 14th, hosted by the Schiller Institute, which is part of a vital series called of forums for a new paradigm change in the world. It's the fourth one since last fall, and this one was titled Attaining Freedom Through Necessity, The Last Chance for Humanity. Now, this delegation here with me are three Australians, and you'll be hearing just in a few minutes from Craig Isherwood. He will introduce his two colleagues. They are from the Citizens Electoral Council in Australia, part of the International LaRouche Movement. And I want to throw in here, according to their website, I believe it might be the 25th anniversary of the founding of this institution.
Yeah, that's right, Marcia, this year.
So welcome, Craig.
Thanks very much. Good to be back. It's been about, I don't know, maybe 8 years since I've been on the LaRouche Show.
Well, that's too long, but I'm very glad to have you back. Some of your colleagues were on. I'll just give a few updates, Craig, because of the, I don't have to remind people that we face a crisis situation. In fact, in the keynotes to this conference, they were given by Mr. LaRouche, who's in Germany, and Helga Zepp LaRouche, his wife. They, if you can take a tiny snapshot of a concept they stress, we're at a crisis point of extinction, but the solution is on the table. You'll be telling us more about that. But I just want to add here for everyone listening, that the latest EIR Online, our Executive Intelligence Review, has those two keynotes in it. In fact, it has the program that you may be giving highlights from as you wish in the next hour. And that date, feature date, is April 19, 2013. And I just visited our editorial offices. They're editing about 10 more of the presentations. It will be flowing out, and you can look at EIR Online and get the right Schiller Institute website to see or hear these, but more on that in a minute. What I want to just address is these two points I just mentioned. We're at a crisis of extinction, but the solution is on the table. As of the last 24 hours, most of our listeners to the LaRouche Show are in the United States and Canada. You've seen a certain point reached in this Boston terrorist situation where there was a lockdown. An actual shelter in place of an entire city, which is unprecedented on our continent. And the point about this, our conversation here today is not going to be going into that. We will next week. There's more to be got out, as Mr. LaRouche was saying this morning when there was transatlantic briefings. You don't want to prematurely go into things, but really the entire there are certain sets of facts. I'm not taking this empirically. I'm saying certain things that happen that if you take it from the highest level, we are in just this extenuated terminal situation. We're allowing to continue this British Empire collaboration with Saudi Kingdom dirty operations in the world there's reason to point out how certain things played into Boston, the terrorism, certainly playing into Southwest Asia, all the hot spots in the world. And that's part of our task to understand that and to put it to an end. Now, as I say, we're not going to go into that more, but we take this into account. Now, on the solution side, I just want to point out that the need to bring to an end this marauding financial syndicate, this thing called the British Empire that's had bailouts, bail-ins. Again, you'll hear more maybe about that in the next hour. I want to stress to everyone listening, keep doing more than you can. We are developing an unprecedented groundswell here in the United States. We now have 17 states where texts have been introduced to reinstate the Glass-Steagall Bank sound banking law. The latest one was Colorado this week. We also found out that on April 11th, Indiana, in one day, April 11th, a student from Purdue University there and some other activists collaborated with legislators to, in one day, the same day, introduce the text, have it circulated, and it passed by acclamation in one of the bicameral legislative houses. So this is really a head of steam that isn't incremental. We don't have to wait till we get to 23 and a half states or something like that. It's self-feeding, and therefore the situation in Washington is completely, it's complete, the potential is growing, not just the support. There are at least 55 members of the House of Representatives who've signed on to H.R. 129, Marcy Kaptur and Walter Jones' bill to reinstate Glass-Steagall. And that's just been in the last, they introduced it, I guess it was introduced in January. So it's only been about 2.5 months that 55 people signed on, whereas the former session of Congress, the Glass-Steagall bill was number 1489, and it had over 85 signatories. That took 2 years. So, as I say, it's not incremental. That's where we are I point out to everyone, know that Mr. LaRouche, he did this from Germany, has resumed the Friday night webcast. There was one last night. Look on LaRouchePAC.com, and they will continue. There was just a logistical reason for them not taking place at a certain time. And I want you to know that, of course, Mr. LaRouche, you could say, led our delegation to the conference, which was in Germany, and it was international. You'll hear about it. But also in the delegation of Americans there, we had Diane Sayre. And I'm very glad that she could report firsthand. She's from New Jersey. She's from the LaRouche Political Action Committee Policy Committee. You see her on the Monday weekly reports of the policy committee. So you can hear from her this coming Monday, the 22nd, on LaRouchePAC.com. So as I say, it's do or die. We have a lot of reasons to appreciate that in a lot of ways. So I want to turn it over to Craig Isherwood, who will introduce our other guests I'm looking at here, handsome guests from Melbourne. And please give us an overview. Thanks.
Yeah, well, thanks, Marcia. Look, we had a delegation of four people travel to Germany, and we're on the return leg home of this trip. I'd like to introduce Ben Pierce and Richard Barden, both are organisers and colleagues of mine in the Melbourne operation, and we all participated in this conference, which was a phenomenal conference, really. I mean, actually, the LaRouche organization is an organization that spans all five continents. So there was a sense that we wanted to be part of this conference because we have a lot to offer. And strategically speaking, you know, we're in the hot seat down in the south in the Asian Pacific region. So it's no longer a case that you know, we can just ignore what's taking place down there. Of course, Obama isn't ignoring it at all with the Asia pivot. So we participated in this conference, and really, I mean, the idea that Mr. LaRouche put on the table very up front was this idea of that he exists in the future, that policy has to be for the future, not from the past, but, you know, to move forward and to actually create a future. And the problem that we have right now is that unless we get the Glass-Steagall policy very quickly in the United States passed, there's no hope for Europe. And there's no hope for anywhere else around the planet. And we can speak and testify to that personally and firsthand in Australia, because the fact is that our entire banking system is bankrupt as well. So that was the first point that Mr. LaRouche put on the table. And then he was very, very explicit about the fact that the game plan is population reduction. And we know a lot about that from Australia, because we've written a lot about green fascism in particular. Where the Prince Philip and the Queen have specifically stated that they want to reduce the world's population down to 1 billion people. And if we don't get the sort of economic development that's necessary on our planet straight away through the process of Glass-Steagall, through the process of national banking credit creation, then we're already in a problem situation where there's not enough food to feed people, which I know you know a lot about because I've been reading a lot of your articles on this exact subject. So that was stressed. Now, over the course of the weekend, we had speakers from all over the world, particularly, you know, a large delegation from Russia that spoke about nuclear energy in part, but also the need for the sorts of reform, the true necessary economic reforms. People like Natalia, Dr. Natalia Petrenko, came from Ukraine. She spoke on the destruction of Ukraine under the free market reforms, where huge numbers of people died, left, industry was literally smashed. And again, I think that those articles will appear in the IR, and I do encourage people to read them, because it's almost unbelievable how this could happen. So the optimism actually came from the point of view that the ideas were put on the table. You had the ideas of the Glass-Steagall. You had presentations from various speakers about the new generations of nuclear power, the different types of nuclear reactors, the thorium-based nuclear reactors, and those sorts of things. So the solutions were put on the table. The urgency was felt throughout the entire conference, and in a sense, it touched every part of the world, and that I haven't seen before in this sort of a conference. And then the other aspect, Marcia, that was really, really profound and important was the Saturday night concert, where Mozart's Requiem was performed. I mean, you see these things, and unfortunately, people physically can't be there. And the best approximation will be on the website at some point, or maybe digitally produced in other ways. But to sit through that presentation was just—it's indescribable in terms of sense of beauty. And the presentations on the Saturday night prior to that of various offerings from Verdi, Giuseppe Verdi, in the fact that it is, what is it, 200th?
Yes.
Anniversary of his birth this year.
Yeah, so we were able to listen to various presentations at C256, the lower journey, which again was just beautiful. What else can you say? So you can see from Helga's remarks too, this nature of human beings, that man is created in the image of the Creator. We're endowed with creativity. When you sponsor that creativity through the de development of education systems and really bring out the potential for mankind, and this beauty is what governs, this creative beauty is what governs everything we do, and that spills over, of course, into science and technology. And that was demonstrated in spades on the Saturday night. We had a speaker from China speaking on the Confucianism, which was interesting to listen to his perspective. We had financial people actually from inside the financial establishment within Japan, literally talking about the need to destroy the investment banking system because of it's so right. He was inside the banking system talking about this, and we're going, whoa, that's even more rougher than what Mr.
He
Lynch
ought to
is doing.
know.
And he did know, that's the point. He was the guy with the finger on, on the pulse, so to speak. So you had all these presentations. I can't even go through them all, really, because unless these other guys want to chip in and add some of the highlights to what they what was at the conference. I mean, the good thing is that we participated from Australia. We got to make a lot more new acquaintances. We met up with people we've known in the past, but it was really demonstrating that we're one fist across five continents as part of the La Ruche movement.
Yeah, I'd be interested, or we'd all be interested in anything special from any point of view, your own from Australia, yourself, or from being younger than 75. I'm joking, I'm sure younger than 30, but go ahead. If you have anything special that stands out.
Fortunately, I got struck down with a bug, so I missed a lot of it.
Oh, that's part of the transatlantic danger, isn't it? Or, excuse
Yeah.
me, trans world.
But particularly the nuclear power question, because we get a lot in Australia of you say nuclear and people take out the crosses and garlic, it's ridiculous. Because and what really strikes you with this presentation on the thorium reactor, whether it's the pebble bed system or other similar, principally the same but different mechanisms, thorium, as the gentleman from South America went through presenting on this, extends the life of the nuclear fuel and increases the efficiency of the production of power by several orders of magnitude. And the thing with thorium is it's generally very dispersed. You have to sift through a lot of material, just general material, to extract small amounts of it. In Australia, we have really I think the only known concentrated reserves of thorium. How many tons did they say it is, Craig?
300,000 tons of extractable thorium, but not one ton has been mined.
Yeah.
It's stunning, Marsha. I mean, this is, see, or you may want to continue.
Oh, just to say, you know, we have, all of us, we've got uranium virtually coming out of our ears. We've got some of the highest quality and most readily available iron ore reserves in the world. Everything you need to build thorium reactors, maglev trains, space technology, all of these rare earths, all these resources are sitting there locked up under national parks, wild rivers, this, that, and the other.
I just can't help but think of the globe. You, speaking of Asia pivot in the good sense, the Trans-Pacific role of Australia for India. India has an echelon of scientists who in particular want thorium nuclear power.
Yeah.
Our own Ramtanu Maitra is a nuclear engineer, he's often on here. And so there you are.
Yeah, well, that was the exciting part, because I hadn't seen some of this later material. So you come to a conference like this and, oh, wow, that's what we need, so we can take it back there. I think in terms of a report, continuing report on the conference, Mr. LaRue stressed the danger of thermonuclear war and this question of looking to the future. Or unless we impeach Obama, get rid of this guy, you know, there is no future. There's no future through not having Glass-Steagall. But then also the other, look, we published a paper last year that laid out for people that you have the immediate danger of nuclear war, whether it be the fuse be Iran, Syria, but also China. But you also have the slow nuclear war, which is the economic destruction through the policies of free trade. So unless you have a paradigm shift, like a new paradigm, which is what this conference was called, away from that, there is no future. And we've been very, very active in Australia, Marsha, in terms of both the Glass-Steagall, but also fighting against this possibility of nuclear war. And last October, we put out a paper, we actually put about 350,000 of these papers out, entitled Act Now, Stop Nuclear War. Join Lyndon LaRouche, Malcolm Fraser to promote peace. Expose Hugh White, Michael Danby, and the push for war. Now, we put this paper into all the policy levels within the country in order to literally stop nuclear war, because the intention of the British is to try and provoke a war if they can't get their war through the collapse of currencies, the collapse of nations, and otherwise. There is no intention of not having 1 billion people. So they'll do it either the war or they'll do it through what they're doing in Cyprus right now, which is a horrible thought. Now, the irony here is here you have Lyndon LaRouche, you know, in fact, joining up with a former Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser, who came out and said that any idea of a war with China is insane. Any idea of this Asia pivot, where, you know, there's an idea of forward basing 2,500 Marines in Darwin, which is part of this Obama plan, he said was absolutely insane. And he came out criticising the fact that Australia shouldn't be America's puppet, it should be no one's puppet, and actually have a policy of real development for China and real collaboration. And our policy with this is the international LaRouche policy, or the idea of the principle of Westphalia, the advantage of the other. Hugh White and Michael Danby and these other guys, they believe in the British zero-sum game idea, that there's always a winner and there's always a loser. Therefore, you have to be on the winning side. And this zero-sum game is a British geopolitical game. It goes way back to the past, and people like Lord Palmerston. It's a typical, actually, Venetian tool of divide and conquer.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the principle of Westphalia, you can have winners. If you have a program for economic development where you're literally having the credits necessary to internally develop your economies, then everyone can actually survive. Trade, actually, as I think Mr. LaRouche has said in the past, actual trade or exports of goods is only when you export the surpluses that you don't need with inside your own country, or in the case of imports, that's where you can't necessarily get certain materials that are inside your own economy. But everything else is so the policy of free trade, where you basically shut down your domestic manufacturing capability because goods are cheaper somewhere else, is a complete, you know, destructive policy. So Hugh White, Michael Danby got slammed with this particular paper, 350,000 copies of them. And, you know, we've now produced another paper along this line which is really a bit of a shocking one maybe to your listeners, but it's what we do in Australia. I mean,
that's true. I've seen the titles. I recommend people at some point say it now, and then we'll do it again. Give your website, because people can look on the periodical.
Yeah, it's our website is www.cecaust.com.au, and we have a archive of all our material on that, as well as our ongoing mobilizations, Marcia.
I'll just give one title apropos of what you were saying before about slow nuclear war and in various forms. You had one a year ago, January, called "Defeat the British Crown's Green Fascist Dictatorship."
Yeah, that was that was a major, major special report. It's a 56-page paper, which we actually went through how Prince Philip himself personally in 1963 came to Australia to establish the Australian Conservation Foundation personally. And we published in that paper in the, we came back, I think, in the early 70s. And we published papers of the Queen's comments about too many people and so forth. We've got nailed chapter and verse, and we are also looking at bringing that out in a book format sometime in the future.
It is. I've seen it's devastating. We've extracted a little bit in EIR, but this is chapter and verse, as you say. But I interrupted you about this the second paper since October about the enemy.
Yeah, well, this one that's just come out, it actually came out literally. It was on the printing presses as we were flying from Singapore to Frankfurt, so we didn't see any hard copies until we got here. But I've got a hard copy in front of me now, which is Glass-Steagall or The British Crown's Mass Murder, Do You Intend to Die for the Banks? And it's got a picture of the Queen and Prince Philip looking very unhappy, and, of course, the picture of the Cyprus situation. And anyone who's thinking realises that there's been a long-term plan in place to literally steal the deposits of money in the banking system to prop up the banking system. And what you see with the shutdown of industry in Cyprus, what you see with the shutdown of the means of supply of just basic everyday commodities into Cyprus because the system's been so shut down, you see the sorts of genocide that is going to happen as this policy takes on a global thrust. Because without Glass-Steagall, without a reorganization of the system, whereby under Glass-Steagall you take the legitimate commercial banking system within every single country that we need for the transference of monetary, in representation of the commerce that takes place, if you don't protect that system and get rid of the merchant banking system, the investment banking system, it is so full of debt and speculation through things like derivatives, then the entire system is going to collapse. But they don't care. They'll just steal our banking deposits and keep propping it up. For a few months. And then Mr. LaRouche said, which is really quite shocking, because the thing with Mr. LaRouche is, as if people know him, as I have for 25 years, he says something and it's usually maybe a year or 18 months further down the track and it happens. And he's saying basically, look, they'll get rid of Bernanke, they'll dump the entire financial system, monetary system the way it is now, and start a completely new, smaller one, and everyone's got the old money, well, they'll just starve. And you can see that this is the mentality of the same oligarchy, the same financial oligarchy that wants to reduce the world's population through greenie policies down to 1 billion people. So our paper takes the shock factor of what's happened in Cyprus. We produced 320,000 of this particular paper. It's an incredibly readable, easily readable paper, and it goes through the three main policy issues. First of all, Glass-Steagall, what it is, why we need it, and the Australian predicates for that. And then we talk about the need for a credit system. And Australia had a national bank. Actually, there's only two countries in the world that have actually ever had a national bank. That's been the United States, where it's had the first and second national bank, and Australia.
And I don't need to remind our listeners, because we tend to be... These are the thoughtful people and informed, but not to be confused with a central bank on behalf of this oligarchy you just described, but a real nation-serving
nation-serving bank. Now this bank was actually established and founded by an American by the name of King O'Malley, and King O'Malley said, "I am the Alexander Hamilton of Australia." I mean, he was quite a forthright sort of guy, and he had to be to get this sort of a bank put up.
This was in the Parliament as well.
This has been a five-hour
speech in the Parliament.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is quite something. And anyway, we got this bank established, and during World War I, it was able to raise $235 million worth of loans for the war effort. It was able to buy the Adelaide Steamship Company, which was able to then provide merchant trades whilst other, because once the war started, a lot of
Oh, yeah,
ships
everything
were.
was paralyzed and
Yeah.
locked in and
So it bought the, as a shipping line, it built the
oh.
transcontinental, the Trans-Pacific Railroad, I think India Pacific we call it now, railroad system. It also funded the crops of farmers in order that farmers could get paid, which is very similar to what the Rural Finance Corporation did here under Jesse Jones and Franklin Roosevelt
In the 30s.
in the 30s. So this bank, functioned for right up until it was privatized fully in 1990s. But when it functioned, it was able to control and develop our economy in ways that we haven't seen since. And in the 1940s, during World War II, it was used by Curtin and Chifley as a means to control the private banking system so that we actually could fight and prosecute World War II. Because we had to change our economy in World War II to a wartime manufacturing economy to be able to provide for the necessities of war. And the Commonwealth Bank played a crucial role as a like functioning as like a national bank to do that. So we've got to go back to that. We've written the legislation for that. It's called the Commonwealth National Credit Bank. And we wrote that legislation in 1994, actually, just after I'd met with Mr. LaRouche, who was incarcerated in the Rochester Federal
Minnesota,
Medicals,
yeah.
Minnesota medical facility. And I mean, it was a really, really profound discussion that I had with him back then, because we were pretty much greenhorns. I mean, it was only 2 years after we were founded, Marshall, so we're political greenhorns and we're all very enthusiastic about everything, and that was good. But I can remember the discussion I had with Mr. LaRouche, because he said, "Craig, the problem you have with Australians goes to the heart of this issue of the Queen and the Crown and the British Empire." He said, "The problem with Australians is that they don't know the difference between autonomy and national sovereignty. Because the point is that you guys are pretty happy to put up with the Queen, but until you get rid of her, you're not going to actually be sovereign." And think about that in terms of what's happening in the world today around the fact that the British Empire controls the entire monetary system. And many nations have surrendered that sovereignty. Like, we're shocked after being, I was last in Germany in 1994, also. Go back there today. Look what's happened to Germany. They've surrendered effectively their sovereignty to the EU. They've lost their currency and have to deal with the euro. And then you drive through the countryside and you see these monsters, these gigantic
Eco crucifixes.
Oh,
The
the wind
wind
turbines.
time wind turbines, yes.
And we're flabbergasted about
Couldn't
just
believe it.
this is a country that developed and sustained itself on nuclear power, and what's happened here? Well, this is the subject. This now subjugated to the British Empire, and many people don't believe the British Empire still exists. Well, I can tell you chapter and verse, as being in the heart of the beast,
You
in the
have
belly of the
authority
beast,
in
we
Australia.
know what the British are like, right? And in a sense, we're in this constant battle, and that gets to the third point. You've got Glass-Steagall, then you've got national banking. Well, the third point that Mr. LaRouche is talking about is large-scale infrastructure development projects, and here in America, it's the NWAPA projects, where Mr. LaRouche says, "You build NWAPA, it'll be the biggest project on the face of the globe the world has ever seen," and that's correct. And then you fund that with the trillion or so dollars, whatever it takes to fund it, but you spend that money, create that credit through the national credit system into building those products and those projects, and you'll transform the way the economy of the United States functions, and people will have, will be, millions of people, tens of millions of people will find employment. It's the same in Australia, Marsha, because we have written the legislation, not the legislation, but the plans for 18 different water projects around Australia. Things like, for example, the Bradfield scheme in far north Queensland. Queensland is a state on the east coast of Australia, and it goes up almost to the equator. not quite to the equator, but the in the far north of that state, you have enormous amounts of rain that simply just flood out to the ocean.
Up to 8 meters in some places, which is how many feet? About
25 feet.
About, yeah, almost 30 feet
yeah.
of rain some years. A dry year up there is 6 meters, which is 20 feet.
So, I mean, that water just floods out to the ocean, and Dr. J.J.C. Bradfield, who was the engineer that actually built the giant coat hanger in Sydney called the Sydney Harbour Bridge, right, which people would know as that bridge, he'd also designed the Bradfield scheme, and the idea was to turn the water inland and have it run down the inside of the country, thereby changing the climate, providing fresh water for all sorts of projects, and that's just one. And, you know, the amount of money that would take to build that project is peanuts compared to the amount of money that is speculated on every day. So you've got, that's just one aspect of it. You know, we need to have a space project, which was, you know, this gloves into what was also discussed at the conference in Florsheim, of the whole, the problems that we have with the asteroids,
potentially strategic defense of the Earth idea. And actually there was a recent, it's something that had been mooted for a long time, but they've recently, I believe, confirmed that almost the entirety of the Australian continental landmass is one giant impact crater from the Precambrian era.
Really?
Yeah, some a comet or a very large asteroid, probably a comet because there's very little in terms of meteorites, you know, actual leftover rocks, so probably a mid-sized long-period comet. Which, you know, these days would be an extinction-level event for any known form of life besides extremophile bacteria in rocks 10 miles below the Earth, the surface of the Earth. So, and what one of the Russian speakers, Kirill Benediktov, pointed out is that, you know, we need to have space capabilities in the Southern Hemisphere. And, you know, really Australia... Both Australia and, of course, Argentina are perfectly positioned for that. There's an old joke that God put all the astronomers in the Northern Hemisphere and all the interesting things to look at in the Southern. we're, again, and with the resources, the natural resources that are sitting there just going begging for want of a scheme to utilise them, we're perfectly placed to contribute to the global... Yeah, the planetary defense. Yeah. If we throw off this British Empire,
succubus.
And actually do it.
In fact, do you want to say one thing just as a sidebar on this? Some of the fine projects in after World War II or before, but like your very famous one of the river diversion, river management system, the Murray River, the Darling River. Or another one, the Snowy Mountains scheme that had tunnels to use water and then produce electricity. But these are being opposed by just what you've described as this international imperial drive to depopulate.
Yeah, in fact, there's yet again, for probably about the sixth time now, there's a drive on by the servants of the oligarchy and our government to privatize the Snowy scheme. Which is insane, but it proves all of their assertions to be false.
The Snowy scheme is the only national project that we have in Australia, Marsh. It was started after World War II as part of a series of great development projects of the Curtin Chifley governments, one of many actually, and it was actually built under the Defence Powers Act. Oh, it was sort of done underneath the radar of a lot of these bureaucrats that wanted to stop it, but it got built and it produced free hydroelectric power and was able to provide water for the Murray-Darling system. The Murray-Darling system itself has the capacity to feed up to 60 million people. So, and this is areas, you know, you've taken desert areas 100 years ago were a desert, provided water to that area, and now it grows a lot of Australian foodstuffs, particularly rock melons, watermelons, all sorts of vine crops, because it's a dry climate, they like that sort of thing. All of that's at risk now because in the last 12 months you've seen the Gillard government basically put through the Murray-Darling Basin scheme, which is literally taking water off the farmers in order to be able to put it through for environmental flows. In other words, they're quite happy to breed mosquitoes in swamps, fill the swamps that were once empty up with water, and take legitimate water off the farmers to actually produce food. And this is all part of this green fascism that we've talked about in our paper, and that has to be opposed, because Australia needs to become more of a food producer. We could easily do that with the sorts of policies of national development that we're proposing. I mean, Professor Lance Endersby, who was a young engineer on the Snowy Mountain scheme, who you met.
Yeah, he came here, and I know he did training in Colorado or elsewhere after the war.
Yeah, and he was part of the young engineers, I think, under the New Deal. He went back to the Snowy Mountain scheme and literally built it. He discovered things called rock bolts. Well, he proposed that Australia could have a population just in the north of Australia of 100 million people. We've got 23 right now. Just 23 million people. In fact, Marcia, if you look at Tasmania, which is a greeny state, I mean, you've had more World Heritage listing in Tasmania than anywhere else.
I also read in your CEC, this is where Prince Philip went, to decree that I'm going to, this is my platform, and the world shall henceforth quit populating.
Yep. The juicy irony, though, is you have this huge areas of Tasmania locked up in World Heritage listing and green projects.
52% of Tasmania is off limits.
52%,
yeah. Roughly.
But it has a population density of 7 people per square kilometre. The population density of the Australian mainland is 2. So if you took the greeny populated Tasmania and applied it to the mainland, we could support 55 million people, but we've only got half of that. So it
doesn't compute.
It doesn't compute, because Australia could become... And it's one of our biggest problems, is we actually don't have enough people to develop the place. Yeah.
And in the 1940s, there's a famous article we quoted on our website. It's there, anyone can find it. But Dr. Bradfield, that I mentioned before, in Ridges magazine in 1941, when the war was really coming home to us in Australia, the curtain had taken office, the troops had been recalled from Europe, broken with the British plan and aligned with the America of Roosevelt and General MacArthur. Dr. Bradfield wrote this article where he said that in order to defend a territory, you have to occupy it. In order to occupy this territory, it requires development. And the problem is not a lack of available resources, including water. It's simply a matter of distributing them properly. And what he pointed out back then was that only 10% of the continental mass of Australia is actually what they call alienated, is the term. It just means not useful. It's inaccessible or simply not worth...
complete, utter wilderness.
Bare rocks,
yeah.
Mountains too steep, mm-hmm. to
There's
material
your gradient,
that
yeah.
won't produce anything. The rest of it simply doesn't have the water, which means it doesn't have the life there to support a human population or any greater population of any sort. But he said then, in the course of the next 50 years, he said, we should aim for at least 50 million people in 50 years' time. We could easily support 90 million, and we have to figure out ways to attract those millions and to make the arrangements such that they'll want to come here and do the work of building the nation and creating a civilization in what is right now just, it's like Shakespeare's blasted heath, but even worse than that, because there's simply no life there. It's not that the soil isn't capable of producing. In fact, it's the same soil types all the way up through a good part of the inland as the around the coast. Very fertile, perfect mineral content for growing all sorts of crops. Mm-hmm. You just need to add water.
And this is against here we are talking about developing Australia against the Queen's appointed via the Australian government appointed climate change scientist Tim Flannery, who says that and said, now he sort of wants to put it under the mattress that he never said it, but he did come out and say it publicly in 1993 that Australia only had a carrying capacity of 6 to 7 million people. Now, this goes in exactly with the mentality of the British oligarchy, the British monarchy, of only wanting 1 billion people. So this, and I think this is where it comes back. I want to bring it back to this concept of what this concept meant on Saturday night, because it sort of gloves into something that we're about to launch into in the next few weeks, Marsha. And this question of culture is the total crucial element. And the optimism that you saw by taking, you know, 80 voices and putting them together for the Requiem and those other performances is a question of this nature of the human being, of who we are as created in the image of God. So in about a month's time, on the 18th and 19th of May, we're holding a conference to celebrate the 25th anniversary of our organisation. It's called Towards a Nobler Manhood and a Public Credit System. Now, we've been studying a lot of Nicholas of Cusa's work in Australia, and what we've discovered also as part of our research is that we actually have a true Republican poet. His name is Charles Harper. And when you read his poetry, you realise that this man understood in his battle against the British, because he didn't like the British at all, what it meant to be created in God's image as a son of God, or, you know, with this power of creativity, what sets us apart from being an animal. And so it was also, it turns out, to be the 200th anniversary of his birth.
Oh, what? Yes.
Right?
He died in 1868. Born in 1813.
He was born in 1813. Mm-hmm. Right, so it's the 200th anniversary of his birth.
1813.
Same age as Giuseppe Verdi. Yeah, so we're going to be having a conference called Toward a Nobler Manhood and a Public Credit System, whereby we're going to be celebrating the life of Charles Harper. We'll be going to look at this question of the public credit system, but we're also spending a lot of time focusing on this idea of creativity itself through the ideas of Nicholas Cusa. And this will challenge a lot of people, because it gets to the heart of trying to really de-bestialize people's version of who they think they are, which is what Helga did a really nice job at the conference as well, in the creativity panel at the end, but also in her keynote address. So we thought, I mean, no, people haven't heard Charles Harper's poetry before, but because we actually every Thursday have someone recite a Charles Harper poem, we thought we might take the opportunity to let people hear a little bit of Charles Harper's poetry. You know, both Richard and Ben could maybe recite one of their poems that they've learned, and just say a little bit about them.
Yep. Guess I'll start. Life and Death by Charles Harper. A little light, heat, motion, breath, then silence, darkness, and decay. This is the change from life to death in him that weareth clay. But time's one drop twixt that and this. Ah, what a gulf of doom it is. The cheek is fair, the eye is bold, the ripe lip like a berry red. Then the shroud clothes them. Thus behold the living and the dead. And how time's last cold drop serene swells to an eternity between. Yet not for sorrow, nor to weep, but through the solemn dark to see that life, though swift, is wonder deep, with death the only key that lets to that mysterious height where earth and heaven in God unite.
Oh, thank you.
So, do you want to say a little bit about that, Ben?
Oh, it's Harper talking about life and death, but death being, you know, it's not just the death of flesh. It's not just man is more, you know, in the mind and the soul. So it's really contrasting that notion of death versus someone who maybe identifies just with their physical nature as opposed to what really makes us human.
So like what Charles Harper always does, he doesn't just treat man as a beast, and there's much higher quality.
That's right.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
We have another one.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, as Craig said, the title of the conference, Towards a Nobler Manhood, which refers to the title of, or the, excuse me, not the title, but one of Harper's poems where he was
he was, what's the word, encouraging this guy was part of the very early foundations of the Republican movement in Australia that was sparked off by Reverend John Dunmore Lang, who was a Scottish Presbyterian minister who had actually travelled to the United States in the late 1830s. Of course, when the internal improvement system was still going on, and brought those ideas back to Australia, and Harper was one of his younger collaborators. And he wrote a poem called This Southern Land of Ours, which I'll recite now. So, yeah, this is This Southern Land of Ours by Charles Harper. With clowns to make our laws and knaves to rule us as of old, in vain our soil is rich, in vain 'tis seamed with virgin gold. For the present only yields us naught, the future only lowers till we have a braver manhood in this southern land of ours. What would Pygmean statesmen but our new world prospects blast by chaining enterprise and thought to the misyielding past, with all its misery for the mass and fraud upholden powers? But we'll have a braver system in this southern land of ours. And lo, the unploughed future, boys, may yet be all our own, if hearts that love their native soil determine this alone, to sow its years for crops of truth and border them with flowers, till we have a nobler manhood in this southern land of ours.
That's beautiful.
Isn't it? I mean, because of our collaboration with our German friends, and hopefully maybe even some of our American friends, we hope to be able to start setting some of this poetry to music, which will be a real first, because being part of the British Empire, we don't have any cultural songs, Marcia, which is a real... We actually made that discovery when we were sitting there with our Russian friends and our German friends, and you know, there's a whole cultural aspect of music which we just didn't have.
Yeah.
And we didn't know what to do. Well, we could sing things like Waltzing Matilda, but that's a horrible idea of Australia. I mean, we're not made up of jumbucks and kangaroos and sheep.
Billabongs.
Or you could sing our national anthem, Advance Australia Fair, but I refuse to, because the problem is in the third verse, it adores the fact that Britannia rules the waves. So here you have this idea of the British Empire sneaking its ideas in again. So I mean, we've got a lot of work to do down there to bring the sorts of policies necessary to really have a sovereign nation. But we also have a cultural culture down there that, you know, we don't tolerate just everything. The Australian people will fight back if they provide the leadership. And for 25 years, I mean, with Mr. LaRouche and with us as the CEC down there, we've been providing this leadership. I mean, today we have thousands of members and supporters. We have a dialogue with the leadership of our country. Even if they don't like us, they still dialogue with us. So we'll take the ideas of this conference in Florsheim back to Australia and increase the collaboration that we have around the world. And we'll become more powerful, and this conference of ours will incorporate even more powerful ideas of unravelling our history. I mean, we have a tremendous history in Australia of the fight between the money power and the and our Republican people, which hasn't really been told. The history of the credit system, for example, has been told to a limited degree, but in terms of what's possible, I've studied a fair bit of the Rural Finance Corporation. That was what was done underneath that, the development projects it funded and how credit was created by Jesse Jones under Franklin Roosevelt at the time. And we had a tremendous opportunity ourselves in 1931 to do that under a treasurer at that point called Ted Theodore. He was proposing to create what's called a fiduciary note issue of £18 million. The Australian pound at that point was tied to the gold at the rate that banks could only lend out. They had to hold 25% of all their loans in gold, so they could only...
There was a limitation.
Yeah, limitation was that when you had the effects of the Great Depression and people couldn't get credit, they started paying all their debts in gold. The banks, of course, lost their gold holdings, therefore they couldn't loan money out by law. So the whole economy was strangled by this gold standard. Theodore, as a very, very courageous and actually talented economist, trade unionist, you know, former miner of the School of Hard Knocks, proposed this $18 million fiduciary note issue, which meant that the credit would be issued without the backing of gold, but the real wealth would be the wealth of the nation itself. So he said that we should take this £18 million and spend that into the Australian economy in physical terms. We should take £6 million of it and spend that to support the Australian farmers that were suffering because they couldn't sell their crops anymore. But the other £12 million was to support the building of public infrastructure, which would directly employ 50,000 men, and indirectly another 50,000 men, to put 100,000 people into work. And by doing this, what you do is actually artificially create inflation and bring prices back to where they were 3 years earlier. And the policy of deflation means that prices fall because desperate companies have to sell their goods in order to be able to get the cash flow to pay for whatever to keep going. The problem is that means that they don't have enough money to employ labour. So up to 30% of the population in Australia in the 1928-29-30 period was unemployed. So by spending this money, was exactly what was done by the Rural Finance Corporation in 1932-33, of creating the credit to stimulate the idle capacity of labour and the idle capacity of the economy that wasn't being used. Unfortunately, Theodore lost that fight because the representatives of the Crown and the Conservative government overruled him in the Senate, and we put up with 10 years of misery, pure misery, because of the direct involvement of the British City of London into our country. Whereas Roosevelt, under the 1933 program, the Rural Finance Corporation, was literally able to transform America into the powerhouse that it became to be able to prosecute a war in 1938 and so forth. So we have this entire rich history, and we've got to stop being a bit less stupid. I think some people need to be a bit less stupid and realize that we aren't hacks of the British Crown, that we can do these things, and we desperately need to do these things. Otherwise, we will find ourselves down to 7 million people in Australia in very short order.
Right, and these are what you mentioned about this history, making it real. It's obviously important for, it's just important in its own right for the nationhood of Australia, in the sense, as you were saying, not just autonomous, but sovereign. But also, we count on being able to create the future, and so everywhere. This is very interesting for anyone in the United States who asks. We have, especially local independent bankers ask, what are we going to do? What happens after Glass-Steagall? Well, there's been moments in other places on other scales, small or large, facing the same thing. How to inject credit? What are the examples?
Well, there's tons of examples around about how credit's being used. You've got all the examples of, for example, the second national bank here in the United States.
Yes.
You've had the creation of the greenbacks by Lincoln. You've had the credit institutions in Germany do the same things. But the key, Marsha, is not the credit per se. That's easy. The question is the political will to direct that credit in quite a significant amount into productive areas first and foremost. That's the difference. Not into a speculative bubble or something that's designed to benefit a short area of the community, but into large-scale sovereign nation-building projects first and foremost. And in many cases, treading on the toes of a lot of the private bankers and those that would prefer that credit being put into very speculative activities, whether it be real estate or so forth.
Yes, prospects for Riverside real estate development instead of something like the entity that was the Tennessee Valley Authority, multi-state.
I think the best example of what Lance Endersby, put on the table was the development of the Australian Ring Road, high-speed.
I'll say about that.
Rail.
Because you're the continent nation.
Yes. So if we had a high-speed magnetic levitation train system that could get us from the bottom of the continent, from Melbourne to Darwin, in less than 24 hours, like at speeds of 600 kilometres per hour, within the space of less than 24 hours, you could have goods shipped from Melbourne to Darwin. I took a trip to a town called Dubbo, which is on that route of a potential route for a magnetic levitation train system, high speed train system. It took 8 hours to get there by plane and by car, right? But you could physically hop on a maglev and be there within 2.5 hours. Now, just imagine if you had people tripping backwards and forwards, or cargo tripping backwards and forwards. You know what would happen if we could do it in 2.5 hours? You've automatically increased the productive capacity of people, because they're not sitting around idle for 5.5 hours. And this is what infrastructure actually does. It catalyzes and creates efficiencies within the economy, so that you can actually get a greater energy flux density per square kilometer into your economy. And you know, through direct energy means like nuclear power, you can even, you know, make sure that you can have large infrastructure projects over large areas. I mean, we proposed that, you know, we would build a magnetic levitation train with modular high temperature gas cooled reactors placed around
the
instead
ramp.
Of having transmission lines, you'd have that sort of a project.
Mm. Right.
So, I mean, there's all these projects, Marsha, that can be done. I mean, this is the optimism, the potentiality is there. It just requires us to really grasp with both hands what we're capable of doing.
Right. Well, we still have a few more minutes, so whatever you only may be for, but if you want to say anything in conclusion, that's great. Otherwise, you know, I would ask, thinking of these, you mentioned the 1930s, because of the British Pound Empire, which directly opposed, well, backed Hitler,
yeah,
but opposed what FDR was doing. That's very vivid. But just in the last few years, the great potential of Australia, even though limited, but was warped totally. This syndicate got rid of your Australian wheat board. The Canadian wheat board was got rid of over the last year. That just meant stability for...
It pitted multinational corporations with their billions of dollars of influence down to the level of a farmer sitting on his remote sheep property and wheat property in the far middle, say the inside of Western Australia, against each other. And the purpose of the wheat boards and the commodity trading boards was to protect the farmer against these sorts of insidious policies of slavery, is actually what it is. You can't call it any less than that. And the takedown is part and parcel of the whole British doctrine of free trade and globalization.
Which means, as you said and described for Australia, but depopulation, because if Australia was part of the world, this was a warping anyway, part of the world grain supply system. Mm. There were certain export zones in the last 30 years,
yeah,
and then those are destabilized.
We had a report last week from our State Secretary, Jean Robinson, who's been on the show too in the past, and she's our State Secretary. She and her husband own a property. They produce sheep and wheat. There was 1,000 farmers turn up to a crisis meeting. We went to that crisis meeting, Marsha, with our Glass-Steagall petition, especially written for the farmers to demand Glass-Steagall, to demand a bank moratorium. We got out 800 New Citizen newspapers. We got out 500 petitions. And what happened was that there was supposed to be an official, this was actually an operation run by the Conservatives, the Liberal Party, in collaboration with an independent member of Parliament. And it's an operation to block Jean out from having any real political influence in that area. We saw the same thing happen with Pauline Hanson several years ago. But the point is that they shut the meeting down because they didn't want our resolution to be tabled, because they knew it would be passed unanimously. What they did is they shut the meeting down. The next morning they lied on ABC radio that the meeting had passed the resolution, all 11 of them. But they shut the meeting down. There was no resolutions passed, nothing. That's how desperate the oligarchy is to stop the movement towards Glass-Steagall, towards real economic development projects. And this is a live report off the ground just from last week.
And where was that?
This is in Western Australia, in a town called Meriden.
Oh, uh-huh.
In the heart of the West Australian wheat belt.
Wheat belt.
50% of farmers are being told that they're going to be foreclosed on this coming season. Because you've got the high Australian dollar, high fertiliser prices, you've got a drought. You've got low commodity prices. You know the mix.
Yes, sure.
So that's the sort of state that farmers are in. And the problem is they keep getting fooled by these idiots that present this light on the hill, so to speak, which is not a light at all. It's a mirage. And when we put these policies forward, it scares them, because it means that everything that they have to admit that everything they've followed, you know, they've followed in the past has been wrong. So we provide that leadership, but it really is going to require a lot more people becoming more courageous and saying, well, we've got to go with what the CEC promotes. And then you'll see all sorts of transformations, which we've been doing for a long time. And, you know, we do have a very strong voice across the country on these sorts of issues, and the politicians just run a mile when they see us coming.
Well, that's great. Well, I guess that's a great note to end on, because thank you so much, Richard and Ben and Craig, for this report from the Australian delegation to the Schiller Institute meeting in Germany, April 13 and 14. And after your own conference, we'd like to have somebody back from that to report here, because as you say, we are so unified in this fight, and so it's so close. And thank you so much for Charles Harper, the poet. So this will conclude our April 20th LaRouche show. Thank you.
Thanks, Marcia.
Thank you.